KRWG News This Week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks for being with us on this 20th anniversary of 9/11. It is the first anniversary when we can say the Afghanistan war, the longest war in American history, is over. And a resettlement of Afghans is underway. The Secretary of Homeland Security says tens of thousands of Afghans have been admitted into the United States, and more are expected as part of an unprecedented evacuation. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas says the U.S. expects to admit more than 50,000 Afghans, but he suggests the total could be higher because of the enduring U.S. commitment to resettle people who helped the American war effort or are particularly vulnerable to Taliban rule. Mayorkas says about 40,000 people have arrived in the U.S. from the airlift. About 20% are U.S. citizens or permanent residents. The Las Cruces City Council discussed this issue this week. They unanimously passed a resolution supporting the U.S. resettlement of Afghan refugees. They also voted to create a citizen ad hoc committee to provide public input on city redistricting. In depth, here's Madison Staten.
Afghan refugees seeking to resettle in the United States now have the full support of the Las Cruces City Council, following a unanimous vote to welcome those fleeing violence in Afghanistan. Councilor Gabe Vasquez noted the proximity to Fort Bliss, where many refugees are temporarily living in the wake of America's military withdrawal from Afghanistan, as one reason the city should prepare to welcome refugees into the Las Cruces community.
I think this is an important statement to make during a time when we actually may see the influx of refugees in our own community here for extended or permanent resettlement. In Doña Ana County, within the Fort Bliss complex, I know we have refugees being taken care of right now, and I think these are folks that gave their lives in many ways to save American lives, and I think we owe it to them to return that favor.
Approximately 2.6 million Afghans are currently living as refugees worldwide, according to the UN Refugee Agency. Kyle Reinhart, a local immigration attorney, says thousands of Afghan refugees will go through Holloman Air Force Base within the next few months.
We hope to be very involved in Holloman Air Force Base, where it's our understanding over the coming months about 5,000 refugees will probably be processed through. As things stand, we don't expect too many will resettle in this specific area, but we want to do our best to support everyone as they process through.
Mayor Ken Miyagashima voiced his full support for Afghan resettlement, emphasizing a need to repay the men and women who worked to help the U.S. military.
Gave up their comfort of their home and for something they believe in, and to be able to make sure that U.S. servicemen and women knew how to communicate and many things that they risked their lives for. And so this is truly something that I support as well, and I wish them the best here, their new life in America.
The council also approved the creation of a citizen ad hoc committee to provide public input on city redistricting. Deputy City Attorney Robert Cabello says the new redistricting efforts will better reflect the population growth reported in the most recent U.S. Census.
The population has grown for this city about 14%, approximately. Went from 2010 and 97,000 to 111,000, approximately. And so it's time to redistrict. So we're going to be using a sort of existing contract between Research and Polling, Inc. from Albuquerque, and they are doing the redistricting for Albuquerque, and they've also did the redistricting in 2010 for the city.
Each city councilor will have the opportunity to select a committee member from their district, while the mayor will choose one individual from anywhere in the city. The committee will work with Research and Polling Incorporated to review redistricting needs within the city. Councilor Yvonne Flores says she hopes the selected committee members are representative of the diverse Las Cruces population.
There may be people in our city who feel or believe that they don't have the wherewithal to be on a districting commission. However, that's who we need. I hate to see any kind of gerrymandering or any kind of shenanigan like of that sort. I just don't anticipate it, not in our city, but then you never know.
Mayor Ken Miyagashima says the redistricting process should be fairly straightforward, but must make allowances for the faster growing districts.
I think it's really this simple. So there's 111,000 residents divided by six, so that's 18,500. The challenge that we've had over the past couple times is districts 5 and 6 are the fastest growing. So in order to keep that 18.5, the others 1 through 4 are going to have to get a little bit larger.
For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
Continuing with our Afghanistan coverage now, the Center for Refugee Services in San Antonio has been overwhelmed by local Afghans in recent weeks who are looking for help getting their families out of Kabul. The agency says that it is ferrying the names of those at risk to Congressman Joaquin Castro and up through the State Department. But now that the last U.S. military plane has left Afghanistan, it's unclear what the path forward for them looks like. Texas Public Radio's Carson Frame has our report.
Since the day after Kabul fell, August 16th, a steady stream of Afghans have lined up in the heat around the Center for Refugee Services, huddled around volunteers with pens and paper. Margaret Costantino directs the center.
So it has literally been a crisis environment for the last 2 weeks. We have probably helped hundreds of Afghan families process requests listing the names of their family members that are in harm's way.
She says the agency has collected at least 1,000 request forms so far, with some heads of household trying to bring as many as 10 to 15 people to join them in the U.S.
These are the gentlemen that helped our American military in some capacity. Many of them were interpreters. Some were cooks. Some were drivers.
Because of their service, most of these requesters are here on special immigrant visas. Costantino says she knows of about 600 refugees already who've built a community in San Antonio over the last several years. Outside the center the day I visit, a group of Afghan men sit hunched over a picnic table, listing the names of family members they believe are under threat. One man, who identified himself as Ghul Wali, says he worked with the U.S. Army in Afghanistan, sandbagging and clearing bunkers after rocket explosions.
I come for a refugee center, and I bring my mom, my sister, my brother, because my country is very bad right now, because I work for American military and 14 years, and I want to try to bring in here because very danger, and I'm worried for my family.
They're now at risk by association, especially his brother, he says, who was shot by the Taliban but managed to survive.
He said, why your brother worked for American Army?
The Biden administration says it's committed to providing safe passage for Americans and Afghans who help the U.S. government, even after the withdrawal deadline. But it's still unclear how the process will work. Meanwhile, Costantino and her Center for Refugee Services colleagues are left fielding impossible questions from worried Afghans.
On one level, we're extremely overwhelmed with sadness. On another level, we know that there's still hope. People are asking me, is there hope? Is there hope? I will never tell anyone there's no hope.
There is confirmation that some of the Afghans who have made it out will end up in San Antonio. Lisa David Kwanjai is the director of refugee resettlement for the San Antonio office of RAISIS.
We're expecting to see about another 100 SIV arrivals over this next month. And then we've also learned just this past week that we will probably very likely be seeing some Afghans arrive with humanitarian parole status.
David Kwanjai says some of the Afghan families that arrived in San Antonio in recent weeks came with only the clothes on their backs.
While there's going to be some rough weeks and months ahead, especially given just the intense chaos that they've just fled, I am still very much hopeful for their long-term integration and resettlement.
She says many Afghans already living in the San Antonio area have opened their homes to those who have fled, whether they're related to them or not.
And I they've given a lot for our freedom, so hope we're able to do this for them.
To that end, both the Center for Refugee Services in San Antonio and RAISIS are asking for the public's help to prepare for these new Afghan arrivals. I'm Carson Frame in San Antonio.
Today is the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. KERA's Elizabeth Myong spoke to Southern Methodist University sophomore Razan Bayan about what it was like growing up after 9/11 as a Gen Z American Muslim.
My mom was pregnant with me when 9/11 happened. when I first heard about it, and this is one of my earliest memories too, I just remember like we were either watching a documentary or a news program or something, and they were talking about something tragic, you could tell. And I asked my mom, like, what are they talking about exactly? And she sort of brushed it aside at first. It's like, oh, this bad thing that happened a few years ago. But then a bit later, like more directly, she told me a few years ago there were some really bad people who crashed these planes into a building and killed a lot of people. And because they were Muslim, everyone blames us for it now. I could not have been younger than 4. I've been to private Islamic schools my whole life, the same way like there are Catholic schools, there are Islamic schools around Dallas. I mean, it's a classroom full of Muslim kids. And I remember one time in either second or third grade, our teacher sat us all down, I'll never forget this, and she told us throughout like the history of America, there have always been people who have been hated, like black people, Jewish people, and right now it's us, we're the target, it's Muslims. And that was so crazy to hear at like 7 or 8 years old. It scared me really bad. I imagine there are better ways to explain that to a kid, but that's how it was addressed at school. It felt like a reality check. It was just the first time I heard some people out there like really hate you just for who you are. She said, we're being targeted right now. And target was the word that stayed in my mind forever. I literally imagined, like as a kid, a little target on my back. Since 9/11, the internet has grown more and more, right? And now we have anonymity. And people can say whatever they want behind a mask. I feel like people don't talk enough about the Islamophobia online. It can be draining. Like, I had to take a break from my phone after pretty much any incident that involves Muslims. When people talk about Islamophobic attacks, they're thinking of like, oh, girls getting their hijabs ripped off, mosques being vandalized, and of course that stuff happens, but Islamophobia on the internet, I've been told that the Quran says my husband can beat me, that I'm brainwashed into wearing hijab, that I don't know, but I'm actually like oppressed, right? I've been called a terrorist online. Maybe we need to have a conversation about internalized Islamophobia. Because I've seen and heard from so many young Muslims questioning parts of their religion that I don't think they would have questioned before 9/11. Before people talked about the hijab like it was a bad thing, do you think that young girls would be like, but why do we have to wear it, right? This is internalized Islamophobia, like suddenly you're hyper aware of all the negative things people say about Islam. And it's one of the reasons I'm very grateful for that my parents put me in Islam schools, because like from day one I was being educated on what, you know, Islam is, why we're asked to do these things. If I wasn't, imagine, and I'm hearing like this constant stream of hijab is bad, Islam is bad, this is bad on social media, on the internet, on the news, how would that affect me, right? So I think internalized Islamophobia is also just this phenomenon after 9/11 that needs to be talked about too.
As we mark the 20th anniversary of 9/11, some thoughts now from commentator Walt Ruppel.
As I think back to the morning of September 11th, 2001, my primary memory is one of confusion. Like most Americans, I didn't know anything about Osama bin Laden or Al-Qaeda, and I couldn't imagine how or why anyone would do such a thing. During an address to a joint session of Congress on September 20th, President George W. Bush told us who committed the act, and he attempted to explain why. Quote, "They hate our freedoms, our freedom of religion, our freedom of speech, our freedom to vote and assemble and disagree with each other," Bush offered. But I understand his reluctance. It's a fraught question. Whatever actions our nation may have taken in the past to provoke those in the Middle East, they did not involve the 2,977 innocent men and women who showed up for work that morning and lost their lives. Looking at the speech now, it all seems incredibly empty and sad. "Our grief has turned to anger and anger to resolution," Bush warned. Whether we bring our enemies to justice or justice to our enemies, justice will be done. In the speech, Bush laid out a series of demands that he knew the Taliban couldn't meet as a pretext to going to war in Afghanistan, just as he would later deliver a list of demands that Saddam Hussein could not meet as a pretext to going to war in Iraq. And the president established an impossible definition for victory, ensuring the two-decade slog that was to follow. It will not end until every terrorist group of global reach has been found, stopped, and defeated, he said. The speech was filled with the kind of Texas swagger that made our 43rd president so endearing. We would win the wars to come, Bush assured us, not only because of our superior military force, we also had God on our side. The course of this conflict is not known, yet its outcome is certain, Bush crowed. Freedom and fear, justice and cruelty have always been at war, and we know that God was not neutral between them. 20 years later, I'm less confused. Now, I understand not only who did it, but who will try to do it again, and why. They are equally convinced that God is on their side, and they are determined that all of us must be on God's side and must follow his dictates as they interpret them. My confusion from that morning later gave way to anger and sadness in that order. That part hasn't gone away in the past 20 years. I suspect it never will. With this week's commentary, I'm Walt Rubel.
Walt Rubel's opinions are his own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KRWG or NMSU. KRWG News This Week. I'm Fred Martino. Thank you for being with us. We now start the most comprehensive coverage of the pandemic in our region. And as schools resume classes following the Labor Day holiday, health experts are warning about the impact of the highly contagious Delta variant. Dr. Caitlin Jettalina is an epidemiologist at the University of Texas School of Public Health. She told NPR Science Friday that Delta has changed the game for schools this year.
It's more transmissible. It's more contagious than previous variants. So one infected kid or one infected teacher on average will infect about 8 others compared to before, whereas one infected would infect about 2 other people.
Jettalina says adults infected with the Delta variant have a higher viral load and contract more severe symptoms, but she says there is no evidence Delta symptoms are more severe for children. With a mask mandate, COVID outbreaks have been more controlled in New Mexico than in some other states. Texas schools, for instance, have reported record numbers. More than 50,000 students and over 13,000 staff have tested positive for COVID-19 since the start of the school year. Well, the pandemic has focused attention on the continuing shortage of healthcare workers, especially nurses. New Mexico State University and the University of New Mexico are working to help ease that shortage through nursing education programs. KRWG public media scholar Sarah Rodriguez reports.
New Mexico has faced a healthcare professional shortage in the past few years. Dr. Alexa Doig, director of New Mexico State University's School of Nursing, says recruiting faculty for the local nursing program is crucial.
Our ability to grow is really dependent on our ability to recruit qualified nurse faculty and to secure clinical placements in the hospitals and community-based health agencies. In addition to having a nursing shortage regionally in the state and nationally, there's also a critical nursing faculty shortage on all these levels. So it makes that recruiting faculty to NMSU and other nursing programs in the region very challenging.
How bad is the nursing shortage? New Mexico hospitals currently have about 6,300 monthly job postings for registered nurses. There are many job opportunities and opportunities for training. Students in NMSU's School of Nursing are able to help short-staffed local healthcare professionals while receiving hands-on experience in clinical rotations.
We appreciate that our healthcare partners are willing to have our nurse trainees in their healthcare settings. They work alongside nurses and other healthcare workers, and while they are there and being trained, I feel that in, and I hear from our healthcare agencies that, you know, the students do, they contribute, they provide patient care. They assist with the nurses and other healthcare workers on in the different agencies and on the different units. And so, you know, I feel that being there, our students are contributing to some degree to the workforce, even though they are, you know, still trainees.
New Mexico universities offer a lot more than just training for students and help with staff shortages. Along with clinical rotations, the University of New Mexico's College of Nursing also provides extensive research for hospitals. Dean Christine Casper says it's an important effort.
We return our contributions by offering support for work that may be done at those hospitals, such as evidence-based practice support, research support. These are some of these areas of expertise that our faculty have that may not be available for the hospital. So wherever we can be of help to the community, we help.
Nursing shortages are most severe in the state's less populated counties. Dean Casper says UNM nursing students are required to work in rural clinical rotations.
We make sure that all the students have essentially a mandatory rural rotation, so that they're exposed to all these very great rurality of the state. We have them rotate with vulnerable populations and disadvantaged communities. So I think that whole package to make sure they're at the cutting edge, to make sure they're getting the best scientifically based education is possible.
In 2020, NMSU's School of Nursing saw 80% of its graduates apply for registered nurse licensure in New Mexico, meaning that those graduates would most likely stay and work in New Mexico hospitals. Over the past 5 years, UNM's College of Nursing has seen 85% of its graduates stay in the state after graduation. Dean Casper credits this statistic to UNM's healthcare partners within the state.
The intensity and specificity of healthcare is changing very fast. So we make every effort to partner with our, you know, UNMH, the medical center here, the system, other major healthcare centers around the state to really expose the students to that increased intensity. You know, keeping nurses in nursing over the long term often depends on the exposures they've had, if they don't realize how intense it is.
By graduating more nurses, UNM and NMSU also help the state's economy. New Mexico lags far behind the national median household income, but the nursing field is a bright spot for the state. The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics reports that salaries for New Mexico nurses rank 21st in the nation. The average salary for a registered nurse is more than $73,000. Over 17,000 nurses are employed in New Mexico. For KRWG Public Media, I'm Sarah Rodriguez.
KRWG News this week, I'm Fred Martino. Thank you for being with us. To education news now, and the Las Cruces Public Schools Board of Education met this week. They talked about the shortage of substitute teachers and a very effective pay increase to get more subs into the classroom, as well as ways to encourage bullying prevention. In depth, here's Madison Staten.
Las Cruces Public Schools has successfully recruited additional substitute teachers, following a shortage that left the district with approximately 190 teachers in the substitute pool. The district is seeking to restore the pool to pre-pandemic levels, working toward a long-term goal of 1,000 substitute teachers. LCPS Chief Human Resources Officer Miguel Serrano attributed the recent interest to an early September job fair, which helped to recruit hundreds of additional substitutes.
We had 72 applicants the first day. The next day we hired 166, for a total of 238 and counting. We heard great things from all the administrators. People came in with a great attitude. We had people with bachelor's, master's. We even had people with PhDs that want to come in and they don't have a job right now and they want to contribute and support our kids in the classroom.
Between August 9th and September 3rd, 3,035 total teacher absences were recorded within the district. Of those, around 34% went unfilled by substitutes and were covered by other LCPS employees. To entice more substitutes, LCPS increased the rate of pay on Mondays and Fridays from $100 to $150 in late August. Serrano says that a permanent substitute position has been created for every school in the district, adding that the district hopes to expand the number of permanent positions soon.
And we're going to add additional permanent substitute positions at each school. Okay, so we started with one. We plan to maybe add two or three more to each campus, so everybody will have four permanent substitutes that can take care of those needs at the campus level.
School Board President Ray Jaramillo raised concern over the quality of applicants, asking for more information on the vetting process.
I know the numbers are important, but I worry about the quality of the people. It's not just numbers that we have to get to. There's a lot of people that can pass a background check, but shouldn't be working with children. There's a lot of times people have a bachelor's degree, but shouldn't be working with children.
Serrano, on behalf of the district's Human Resources Department, says the LCPS selection process is more thorough than in other states, noting some candidates did not advance.
I kept hearing it all throughout that the quality. I heard not the quantity, I heard quality. In our department, we have a very rigorous interview process. So we had several people that we didn't think were ready to serve our students, and they will not serve our students.
The board also discussed the formation of a proclamation for National Bullying Prevention Month in October. Superintendent Ralph Ramos voiced ideas on how to increase anti-bullying efforts within schools.
We're now looking at restorative practices, and really out-of-school suspension is not the only answer. And it starts with daily announcements over the intercom, starting our school day out, reminding, hey, thank you for committing to no bullying, no violence, no drugs, with constant reminders. Not only that, celebrations at schools.
School Board President Ray Jaramillo says he hopes that the proclamation is not just a one-time effort, but that an anti-bullying culture can become better ingrained within the LCPS community over time.
I see this not as just a one-time thing, but I really like to see this, you know, over the next 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, really turn things around. And that's changing a culture. And changing a culture is not done with a program or one thing. Culture is changing the way people look at things. And I think that if we can do that, it's going to take all of us. If we're just in the middle and things are happening around us, we're not going to be very successful. So I'd really like to see the outreach into that.
For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
Big political news in Texas this week as well. A number of federal lawsuits seek to block new voting restrictions signed into law Tuesday by Texas Governor Greg Abbott. LULAC, the League of United Latin American Citizens, filed a lawsuit challenging Senate Bill 1. Minutes after the governor signed it into law, SB 1 bans drive-through voting, 24-hour voting. It also creates new criminal penalties related to voting. LULAC is asking a federal court to block the new voting restrictions. Other plaintiffs include Voto Latino, the Texas Alliance for Retired Americans, and the Texas American Federation of Teachers. They argue SB 1 is unconstitutional and will have a disproportionate impact on Hispanic and Black voters. LULAC President Domingo Garcia says the law is not about preventing voter fraud, as Republicans claim.
We know what this is all about. It's about making sure that Black and Brown people don't vote in Texas. It's about taking away Americans and Texas' right to vote.
And there are at least three other federal lawsuits challenging SB 1. Meantime, the Texas Medical Association is reacting to the state's newest anti-abortion bill by saying enough is enough. The new law is a near total ban on abortion and one of the strictest such measures in the country. Board of Trustees Chair Dr. Rick Snyder says the TMA is hearing from their physician members, who are alarmed at how SB 8 creates a scheme of deputizing private citizens to carry out what the state itself cannot do.
They were very concerned about this, you know, really radical vigilante type third party participation in the physician patient relationship. When you encourage any third party citizen to really get involved in that relationship and how their health care is delivered, that's a very dangerous precedent.
The TMA is also opposed to SB 4, which passed in the second special session. It limits access to abortion-inducing pills and would make it a criminal act for physicians to give these medications to patients more than 7 weeks into a pregnancy. Also on the Health Watch this week, as overdose deaths in New Mexico have surged during the pandemic, research shows a big gap in treatment available for opioid use disorder at the state's hospitals. One of the study's authors is Dr. Eileen Barrett, Director of Continuing Medical Education at the University of New Mexico. She spoke with KUNM's Nash Jones about the status of opioid use and treatment in the state.
New Mexico has had a pretty severe epidemic of opioid use disorder and associated overdose deaths for a lot longer than a lot of the rest of the country and also a lot of the states that are in the Intermountain West. Even before the national headlines were talking about the opioid use disorder that was really driven by a flooding of the market with prescriptions for oxycodone, that landscape for us has been going on for a lot longer and has been a lot more severe and then really just became worse, coincident with what has happened with the rest of the country.
Your recent research looked at the availability of medications for opioid use at acute care hospitals in New Mexico, specifically buprenorphine and naloxone. Can you break down what these medications are and how they're used?
Buprenorphine naloxone is a combination medication called Suboxone. The naloxone part is the drug that is used to reverse overdoses, versus the buprenorphine part of it is an opioid. Buprenorphine allows someone to be able to reduce the risk of overdose if they do inject, snort, or take other pills. And it also decreases the risk of overdose because it isn't as sedating and also doesn't really induce euphoria in the same way. And then the combination of them, why that's so powerful is because it's a deterrent. For the vast majority of people, if they are taking this medication, they are taking it to manage their own withdrawal. They're not taking it to be high, if you will.
What does accessibility to this medication look like in New Mexico?
In an ideal scenario, whenever someone who has an opioid use disorder wants to get treatment, they're able to get treatment the same day. We should think of being able to access treatment for a substance use disorder as a medical emergency. We would never not have an antibiotic, right? So in our case, when we contacted all the hospitals in the state, what we found was that roughly half didn't have Suboxone. Why that was also surprising and disappointing is that we did ask, are you able to get it within 24 hours? Because the person will withdraw without it. And what we found was that places couldn't.
What is the impact of a hospital not having these medications on hand or available quickly? What happens?
The consequences are that the patient can't be treated for their opioid use disorder. What that could mean for someone is they are likely to withdraw, and that withdrawal will increase their risk of leaving the hospital against advice, which then puts them at a risk to relapsing to injecting or smoking behaviors. Then they're at increased risk for overdosing because when they go back to using, that dose may likely be too much for them.
Is there a unique risk when rural residents in particular don't have access to this treatment?
It really is. Rural areas are much less likely to have any treatment for a substance use disorder. So if they can't get it in the hospital, they probably won't be able to get it someplace else. Ideally, we want people to not have to travel a great distance to be able to receive what should be regarded as a foundational primary care to help people be well and to avoid harm.
Why do nearly half of our hospitals not have this treatment available?
There is a persistent stigma against people with opioid use disorder. That could be one reason, and it very likely is the main driver. There also is a persistent misunderstanding that one has to receive different or advanced training or have a special certification to be able to prescribe Suboxone in the hospital, and that's not actually the case. The last one is that sometimes people think that these medications don't work. The mistaken belief that you substitute one addiction for another. Instead, we should think about medications for opioid use disorder, just like chemo and insulin, which is that it's just another medication that helps someone achieve health.
Mm-hmm. What can be done to increase the availability of these medications at New Mexico acute care hospitals?
Every person who is a healthcare worker, every person who is a patient should contact the hospital where they've received care or where their loved one has received care, whether it was for opioid use disorder or not, and ask them if this is available and ask them to add it because your voice matters. And if we want to assume that there is good intent, just asking the question may help people do the right thing. The last thing I think that we would come to would be if regulatory agencies such as the Board of Pharmacy were to collaborate with those hospitals to make sure that everybody has this available.
Dr. Eileen Barrett, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Nash.
Well, this week, KRWG Public Media begins our Las Cruces School Board forums in conjunction with the League of Women Voters of Southern New Mexico. I am joined by the League's Dale Yeo in talking with District 1 candidates Ray Jaramillo and Abelardo Balcazar. We have a portion of our District 1 forum now, beginning with Abelardo Balcazar.
Well, the reason I'm running for the school board is
The numbers clearly show that the schools in my district are not meeting proficiency levels in reading, writing, in reading, math, and science. We need a change.
Okay.
I decided the things that I want to do to solve this problem is, number one, increase parental involvement, increase investment in STEM programs in the elementary schools, and finally, increase investment in after-school education programs for all our students.
Thank you very much. Ray, we move to you now for your answer on that question.
It's quick. Thank you, Fred. You know, it's quick. Two of my priorities are the reason why I'm running for re-election is I'm a parent. I'm a parent of a high school senior. My son just graduated from Las Cruces Public Schools, and I've invested as a parent in our school district. So that's number one. And number two, for over half of my life, over 26 years, I have been an educator. And it's my passion. These things that we're dealing with here in Las Cruces Public Schools is what I live for. And so I think that as an early childhood educator, I can bring my perspective into policies and things that we're doing around education here in Las Cruces Public Schools. I guess my biggest priority would be to have some stabilization within our district. We've had three superintendents in the last 4 years while I've been elected, and I would like to bring some stabilization. And I would also like to bring, you know, I guess my biggest priorities would be a focus on early childhood education. I think that's the foundation, and also a CTE program.
Okay, thank you, Ray. We're out of time. Our second question now from Dale.
Ray, what experiences or skills have prepared you to serve as a board member?
That's a good question, Dale. Thank you very much. Well, I am I have a master's degree in early childhood education, and I have worked with young children for over 26 years, like I mentioned in Fred's previous comments. The other thing is that I'm a parent, and so all of these things combined with the last 4 years of working within the district, I think that I owe it to my community, and I owe it to the investment of my district to be able to continue some of those things. There's a big learning curve when you jump into a position like this. And after the last 4 years, I would like to use my experience and my connections that I've made with families and to continue the good stuff that we're doing here at Las Cruces Public Schools.
And Abelardo?
Well, I am a 20-year Navy vet. I've served in the military in the United States Navy for 20 years. And I believe my leadership in the military has shown me how to work with others to achieve solutions to problems. And I am also a graduate of New Mexico State. I have a degree in business. And we need to go back to understanding that we need to make good, informed, decisive decisions when it comes to our students' education. So as a member of the military, as being married for 24 years, raising my children, I see the needs that our schools have. And caring for my children, caring for my grandchildren, nieces and nephews, and our students in our community will help me make the informed and decisive decisions that are going to improve our children's education.
Abelardo, our next question, how does the board member role differ from the role of the superintendent or the administration?
Well, the board member's role primarily is to set policy for the school district. It's also very important for the school board member to be familiar with the budget and how we're spending money that's allotted for education, and to support the superintendent in implementing the policies that are passed by the school board by giving the superintendent the resources that superintendent needs to implement the policies that are passed by the school board. That's why it's important to be familiar with the deficiencies and the needs that are not being met within the education system, so we can set policy to address it.
Thank you, Ray.
That's a good question. And a lot of people out in the public don't understand the difference between the two roles. The the school board has five things that they are able to do. That's they have control over the budget. They can hire and fire the superintendent. They're in charge of all policy, land acquisition, and then we have the authority to sue and be sued. That's it. The day-to-day operation is what the superintendent is in charge of. The only employee that we have direction over is the superintendent. And so therefore, you know, our role is to support, to come together as a group. A school board member is never alone. It's always a group, and we act as a group, we vote as a group. And we, you know, set the policies that adhere to our mission and our goals of our district. And our budget should reflect that of our mission and our goals. And so HB 212 clearly defines the two different, and it's very, as we've seen in the news recently across the state, many school boards have crossed those lines. And it's very important to understand where your role is and how to utilize your role in making the best for your district.
Thank you, Ray. Dale.
Ray, should the school board take action on civics education, including the understanding of democracy and voting rights? Please explain.
So the quick question, or the quick answer, is absolutely yes. A good friend of mine who was a school board member, Mr. Maury, he was Costrell, was very adamant about getting civics back into our classroom. And I stand for that. And if I'm elected, I will continue to advocate to continue to get that. I think it's an important part of our democracy that students understand their role and the importance of civics and voting and finding out, just like you are here, the candidates, what we stand for. And so absolutely, I believe that civics is a vital part of our education, and for far too long it's been lost. And so I would love for that to be a priority of our district.
Thank you. Abelardo?
Yes, it's very important to have civics education in our schools. Our constitutional republic, the powers are derived from the people, and our students need to have that preparation. So when they are of age to be part of our local government, state government, federal government, that they have the information and the tools to be able to make informed decisions that are going to affect the future and the direction of our country. So I am definitely in support of civics education if it's based on the founding principles of the Constitutional Republic of the United States.
Abelardo, explain your position on charter schools. Do you see positive or negative impacts of these schools?
Yes, I see charter schools as a very positive part of our educational system. When we give parents the choice of where they send their children to school, we empower the parents. A child should not be doomed by the zip code of where they live to attend a school that may not be performing where it should be. We need to empower parents to have more choice over the education of their children and give less authority to agencies on how a child should be educated.
Ray, your thoughts on this?
Yeah, so that's a good question. And, you know, I think that there's room for charter schools. I want to say that I believe in our public schools, and I believe that they are, they have all the necessary tools. But, you know, just like we're talking about equity, it's been in the news recently. You know, I think that oftentimes not everyone learns in the same direction. So I think that there is room for some charter schools if they're done right. We've also seen charter schools that have abused the system and that are in there for just making money. And so I really support what's best for children. And if that is an alternative way of learning, then I think that's good. So it just depends, I think, on the school and what they're doing, and if they're abiding by what they're supposed to be doing and for children. But as a moneymaker, I don't see it like that. And sometimes charter schools are that way. But I think that, like I said, all children learn differently. And if they can utilize that, then that would be good.
All right. Thank you, Ray. Dale?
Okay, Ray. What would you do to promote parental involvement with the schools?
Well, you know what? Right now, it's something that I think that we have been doing through COVID-19. We've had to readjust a little bit on parental involvement. You couldn't come to school board meetings. We had to do those via Zoom. I think that we need to get out there a little bit more. I think we need to invite parents. I think when we put out surveys to parents that we need to listen to them. I think they are a big stakeholder, and I think we send the wrong message when we do things that are against, you know, some of the what the parents want. I think that there's a balance between all stakeholders, and I think that once we utilize all of our options to be able to get those that feedback in, whether it be technology or getting into the classroom. But I'm actually a parent, so I understand how to get those that information to the right people that are making the decisions.
Abelardo, what would you do?
Yes, definitely we need to listen to parents. When parents make the time to attend a school board meeting, we need to listen to their input and seriously consider input before we make a decision on policy for the schools. In addition, we need to increase our investment in increasing parental involvement in schools. Right now, the current budget priorities has the investment for parental involvement at less than 1% of the budget. We need to put our money prioritize our spending on things that are going to improve student outcomes. And having an involved family in a student's education is going to increase and improve student outcomes for all our students.
Abelardo, how can a Board of Education best communicate with its various constituent groups?
It's very important to use all forms of communication. Right now, with social media, we need to use all those means of communication: Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. We need to. I remember when I was in school, a lot of times when we wanted to get messages to my parents, we would send information with the students to get to their parents. We also need to empower the parent groups back in each school, get those reorganized, get them empowered, get them involved, get them resources and training so they can be a good influence in our schools. We need to open those lines of communication by encouraging it so that when parents do communicate with us, that we listen and that we don't make them feel that they are not being heard.
Thank you. Ray.
Fred, if you don't mind, if you could repeat the question, please.
Sure, absolutely. And the question is, how can a Board of Education best communicate with its various constituent groups?
And I think yes, there's a lot of different ways. And through technology is one way, through our website is another way. But really, you know, being in the community is the biggest way. I've been in our community now for over 30 years. I go to work with our community members, with our parents. I go to shop at the stores where people are shopping. They don't have any problems with me while I'm waiting in line to cash out my groceries to tell me a little bit about what's happening in their schools. And then to be present. To be present inside the schools, to be present inside of our community, not just at sporting events, but at music events, at arts things. And so there's all sorts of different ways that our school board, and it really it is to be present, be with the people that are actually, have the students in our district and really be able to talk to them and the relationships. And I think the relationships are huge. People know how to get a hold of me. They know where I live. They know where I work. And I've made it so that parents feel comfortable contacting me.
Thank you. Dale.
Ray, what should the Las Cruces Public Schools be doing to increase equity?
That's a great question. It's also a controversial question, and I like it. Policy JBC is what you're referring to, and I think that it's important that people understand that that it's about time that we level the playing field for all of our students. And what I mean by that is giving our students the necessary tools to be successful. Does that mean just giving the book to everyone? No, that is equality. Equity means providing some additional support to that student that may not be able to read that book in its language, or maybe that someone studies something online a little bit better than they do in person. That is what equality is about. And also bringing in others' perspectives. We all have grown up with a different cultural lens, and being able to say, to making an environment feel comfortable for them to express their lens and how they grew up, and incorporating that into our education is exactly what Policy JBC is about.
Abelardo.
Yes, I believe that we should definitely honor and celebrate the diversity of our students. However, I also believe that it's important not to be divisive, not to focus on our differences, but to focus on our common humanity. The basic essence of equity is fairness. As long as we're treating our students fair, providing them the resources they need to succeed throughout the entire student body, I believe we are achieving equity in our schools.
That was Abelardo Balcazar. Before that, Ray Jaramillo. They are the District 1 candidates for the Las Cruces Public Schools Board of Education. And you can watch that entire forum tomorrow morning at 11 on KRWG-TV or anytime on the Newsmakers page in the local TV section at krwg.org. Finally, our look ahead to a big story next week. The once-in-a-decade redistricting process is underway in New Mexico, with proposed maps scheduled for publication next Thursday. More now from the New Mexico News Connection's Roz Brown.
New Mexico's 7-member Citizen Redistricting Committee, established by an act signed into law this year, has been gathering public input in recent weeks. Dick Mason, who represents the New Mexico League of Women Voters, says that group is pushing for as much transparency as possible.
On September 16th, they're going to be publishing the concept maps. And then after that, they're going to go out with public meetings with these concept maps to get people's input on those maps.
Advocates for fair redistricting say it's supposed to preserve communities of common interest. That's especially important in New Mexico, where nearly 48% of respondents to the 2020 census identified ancestry linked to Latin America or other Spanish-speaking areas, the largest percentage of any U.S. state. Mason says the state has a long history of having its redistricting maps litigated and decided by the courts, and that's why it's important that everyone is unified over the final map.
And we also want to be sure that particularly the Native Americans, their wishes are paid attention to, you know, between the Pueblos and the Navajo Nation and the Apache reservations.
Based on limited population growth in the past 10 years, the state will have 3 congressional districts, the same as it had following the 2010 census. For the first time in 30 years, Democrats outnumber Republicans in both houses of the legislature, and the governor also is a Democrat. A special legislative session to review maps is tentatively scheduled for the first week of December. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
That's KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks so much for being with us. Broadcasting from New Mexico State University, KRWG Las Cruces, and KRXG Silver City. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.